who attended Pierre and visited him every day, though he considered it his duty as a doctor to pose as a man whose every moment was of value to suffering humanity, would sit for hours with Pierre, telling him his favourite anecdotes and his observations on the characters of his patients in general, and especially of the ladies. "It's a pleasure to talk to a man like that. He is not like our provincials," he would say. There were several prisoners from the French army in Auriol, and the doctor brought one of them, a young Italian, to see Pierre. This officer began visiting Pierre, and the princess used to make fun of the tenderness the Italian expressed for him. The Italian seemed happy only when he could come to see Pierre, talk with him, tell him about his past, his life at home and his love, and pour out to him his indignation against the French and especially against Napoleon. "If all Russians are in the least like you, it is sacrilege to fight such a nation," he said to Pierre. "You, who have suffered so from the French, do not even feel animosity toward them." Pierre had evoked the passionate affection of the Italian merely by evoking the best side of his nature and taking a pleasure in doing so. During the last days of Pierre's stay in Auriol, his old Masonic acquaintance, Count Villarski, who had introduced him to the lodge in 1807, came to see him. Villarski was married to a Russian heiress who had a large estate in Auriol province, and he occupied a temporary post in the commissariat department in that town. Hearing that Bezukhov was in Auriol, Villarski, though they had never been intimate, came to him with the professions of friendship and intimacy that people who meet in a desert generally express for one another. Villarski felt dull in Auriol, and was pleased to meet a man of his own circle, and, as he supposed, of similar interests. But to his surprise, Villarski soon noticed that Pierre had lagged much behind the times, and had sunk, as he expressed it to himself, into apathy and egotism. "You are letting yourself go, my dear fellow," he said. But for all that, Villarski found it pleasanter now than it had been formerly to be with Pierre, and came to see him every day. To Pierre, as he looked at and listened to Villarski, it seemed strange to think that he had been like that himself but a short time before. Villarski was a married man with a family, busy with his family affairs, his wife's affairs, and his official duties. He regarded all these occupations as hindrances to life, and considered that they were all contemptible because their aim was the welfare of himself and his family. Military, administrative, political, and Masonic interests continually absorbed his attention. And Pierre, without trying to change the other's views and without condemning him, but with the quiet, joyful, and amused smile now habitual to him, was interested in this strange, though very familiar, phenomenon. There was a new feature in Pierre's relations with Villarski, with the princess, with the doctor, and with all the people he now met, which gained for him the general goodwill. This was his acknowledgement of the impossibility of changing a man's convictions by words, and his recognition of the possibility of everyone thinking, feeling, and seeing things each from his own point of view. This legitimate peculiarity of each individual, which used to excite and irritate Pierre, now became a basis of the sympathy he felt for and the interest he took in other people. The difference, and sometimes complete contradiction, between men's opinions and their lives, and between one man and another, pleased him, and drew from him an amused and gentle smile. In practical matters, Pierre unexpectedly felt within himself a centre of gravity he had previously lacked. Formerly, all pecuniary questions, especially requests for money, to which, as an extremely wealthy man, he was very exposed, produced in him a state of hopeless agitation and perplexity. "To give or not to give?" he had asked himself. "I have it, and he needs it. But someone else needs it still more. Who needs it most? And perhaps they're both impostors." In the old days, he had been unable to find a way out of all these surmises, and had given to all who asked as long as he had anything to give. Formerly, he had been in a similar state of perplexity with regard to every question concerning his property, when one person advised one thing and another something else. Now, to his surprise, he found that he no longer felt either doubt or perplexity about these questions. There was now within him a judge who, by some rule unknown to him, decided what should or should not be done. He was as indifferent as heretofore to money matters, but now he felt certain of what ought and what ought not to be done. The first time he had recourse to his new judge was when a French prisoner, a colonel, came to see him, and after talking a great deal about his exploits, concluded by making what amounted to a demand that Pierre should give him 4,000 francs to send to his wife and children. Pierre refused without the least difficulty or effort, and was afterwards surprised how simple and easy had been what used to appear so insurmountably difficult. At the same time that he refused the colonel's demand, he made up his mind that he must have recourse to artifice when leaving Auriol, to induce the Italian officer to accept some money, of which he was evidently in need. A further proof to Pierre of his own more settled outlook on practical matters was furnished by his decision with regard to his wife's debts and to the rebuilding of his houses in and near Moscow. His head steward came to him at Auriol, and Pierre reckoned up with him his diminished income. The burning of Moscow had cost him, according to the head steward's calculation, about 2 million rubles. To console Pierre for these losses, the head steward gave him an estimate showing that despite these losses, his income would not be diminished, but would even be increased if he refused to pay his wife's debts, which he was under no obligation to meet, and did not rebuild his Moscow house and the country house on his Moscow estate, which had cost him 80,000 rubles a year and brought in nothing.
"Yes, of course that's true," said Pierre, with a cheerful smile. "I don't need all that at all. By being ruined, I have become much richer."
But in January, Savelich came from Moscow and gave him an account of the state of things there, and spoke of the estimate an architect had made of the cost of rebuilding the town and country houses, speaking of this as of a settled matter. About the same time he received letters from Prince Vasily and other Petersburg acquaintances speaking of his wife's debts. And Pierre decided that the steward's proposals, which had so pleased him, were wrong, and that he must go to Petersburg and settle his wife's affairs, and must rebuild in Moscow. Why this was necessary he did not know, but he knew for certain that it was necessary. His income would be reduced by 3/4, but he felt it must be done. Villarsky was going to Moscow, and they agreed to travel together. During the whole time of his convalescence in Auriol, Pierre had experienced a feeling of joy, freedom, and life. But when, during his journey, he found himself in the open world and saw hundreds of new faces, that feeling was intensified. Throughout his journey, he felt like a schoolboy on holiday. Everyone, the stagecoach driver, the post-house overseers, the peasants on the roads and in the villages, had a new significance for him. The presence and remarks of Villarsky, who continually deplored the ignorance and poverty of Russia and its backwardness compared with Europe, only heightened Pierre's pleasure. Where Villarsky saw deadness, Pierre saw an extraordinary strength and vitality. The strength which in that vast space amid the snows maintained the life of this original, peculiar, and unique people. He did not contradict Villarsky, and even seemed to agree with him, an apparent agreement being the simplest way to avoid discussions that could lead to nothing. And he smiled joyfully as he listened to him.
Chapter 14. Moscow. It would be difficult to explain why and whither ants whose heap has been destroyed are hurrying, some from the heap dragging bits of rubbish, larvae and corpses, others back to the heap, or why they jostle, overtake one another and fight, and it would be equally difficult to explain what caused the Russians, after the departure of the French, to throng to the place that had formerly been Moscow. But when we watch the ants round their ruined heap, the tenacity, energy, and immense number of the delving insects prove that despite the destruction of the heap, something indestructible, which, though intangible, is the real strength of the colony, still exists. And similarly, though in Moscow in the month of October there was no government, no churches, shrines, riches, or houses, it was still the Moscow it had been in August. All was destroyed except something intangible, yet powerful and indestructible. The motives of those who thronged from all sides to Moscow after it had been cleared of the enemy were most diverse and personal, and at first for the most part savage and brutal. One motive only they all had in common, a desire to get to the place that had been called Moscow, to apply their activities there. Within a week, Moscow already had 15,000 inhabitants, in a fortnight 25,000, and so on. By the autumn of 1813, the number, ever increasing and increasing, exceeded what it had been in 1812. The first Russians to enter Moscow were the Cossacks of Vintsingorod's detachment, peasants from the adjacent villages, and residents who had fled from Moscow and had been hiding in its vicinity. The Russians who entered Moscow, finding it plundered, plundered it in their turn. They continued what the French had begun. Trains of peasant carts came to Moscow to carry off to the villages what had been abandoned in the ruined houses and the streets. The Cossacks carried off what they could to their camps, and the householders seized all they could find in other houses and moved it to their own, pretending that it was their property. But the first plunderers were followed by a second and a third contingent, and with increasing numbers plundering became more and more difficult and assumed more definite forms. The French found Moscow abandoned, but with all the organizations of regular life, with diverse branches of commerce and craftsmanship, with luxury and governmental and religious institutions. These forms were lifeless, but still existed. There were bazaars, shops, warehouses, market stalls, granaries, for the most part still stocked with goods, and there were factories and workshops, palaces and wealthy houses filled with luxuries, hospitals, prisons, government offices, churches and cathedrals. The longer the French remained, the more these forms of town life perished, until finally all was merged into one confused, lifeless scene of plunder. The more the plundering by the French continued, the more both the wealth of Moscow and the strength of its plunderers was destroyed. But plundering by the Russians, with which the reoccupation of the city began, had an opposite effect. The longer it continued and the greater the number of people taking part in it, the more rapidly was the wealth of the city and its regular life restored. Besides the plunderers, very various people, some drawn by curiosity, some by official duties, some by self-interest, house owners, clergy, officials of all kinds, tradesmen, artisans, and peasants, streamed into Moscow as blood flows to the heart. Within a week, the peasants who came with empty carts to carry off plunder were stopped by the authorities and made to cart the corpses out of town. Other peasants, having heard of their comrades' discomfiture, came to town bringing rye, oats, and hay, and beat down one another's prices to below what they had been in former days. Gangs of carpenters, hoping for high pay, arrived in Moscow every day, and on all sides logs were being hewn, new houses built, and old charred ones repaired. Tradesmen began trading in booths. Cookshops and taverns were opened in partially burned houses. The clergy resumed the services in many churches that had not been burnt. Donors contributed church property that had been stolen. Government clerks set up their baize-covered tables and their pigeonholes of documents in small rooms. The higher authorities and the police organized the distribution of goods left behind by the French. The owners of houses in which much property had been left, brought there from other houses, complained of the injustice of taking everything to the faceted palace in the Kremlin. Others insisted that as the French had gathered things from different houses into this or that house, it would be unfair to allow its owner to keep all that was found there. They abused the police and bribed them, made out estimates at 10 times their value for government stores that had perished in the fire, and demanded relief. And Count Rostopchin wrote proclamations. Chapter 15. Pierre visits Princess Maria. At the end of January, Pierre went to Moscow and stayed in an annex of his house which had not been burnt. He called on Count Rostopchin and on some acquaintances who were back in Moscow, and he intended to leave for Petersburg 2 days later. Everybody was celebrating the victory. Everything was bubbling with life in the ruined but reviving city. Everyone was pleased to see Pierre. Everyone wished to meet him, and everyone questioned him about what he had seen. Pierre felt particularly well disposed toward them all, but was now instinctively on his guard for fear of binding himself in any way. To all questions put to him, whether important or quite trifling, such as where would he live, was he going to rebuild, was he going to Petersburg, and would he mind taking a parcel for someone, he replied, "Yes, perhaps," or "I think so," and so on. He had heard that the Rostovs were in Kostroma, but the thought of Natasha seldom occurred to him. If it did, it was only as a pleasant memory of the distant past. He felt himself not only free from social obligations, but also from that feeling which, it seemed to him, he had aroused in himself. On the third day after his arrival, he heard from the Drubetskoys that Princess Maria was in Moscow. The death, sufferings, and last days of Prince Andrei had often occupied Pierre's thoughts, and now recurred to him with fresh vividness. Having heard at dinner that Princess Maria was in Moscow and living in her house, which had not been burnt, in Vozhvizhenka Street, he drove that same evening to see her. On his way to the house, Pierre kept thinking of Prince Andrei, of their friendship, of his various meetings with him, and especially of the last one at Borodino. Is it possible that he died in the bitter frame of mind he was in then? Is it possible that the meaning of life was not disclosed to him before he died? Thought Pierre. He recalled Karatayev and his death, and involuntarily began to compare these two men, so different, and yet so similar, in that they had both lived and both died, and in the love he felt for both of them. Pierre drove up to the house of the old prince in a most serious mood. The house had escaped the fire. It showed signs of damage, but its general aspect was unchanged. The old footman, who met Pierre with a stern face, as if wishing to make the visitor feel that the absence of the old prince had not disturbed the order of things in the house, informed him that the princess had gone to her own apartments and that she received on Sundays. "Announce me. Perhaps she will see me," said Pierre. "Yes, sir," said the man. "Please step into the portrait gallery." A few minutes later, the footman returned with Dessalles, who brought word from the princess that she would be very glad to see Pierre if he would excuse her want of ceremony and come upstairs to her apartment. In a rather low room lit by one candle sat the princess, and with her another person dressed in black. Pierre remembered that the princess always had lady companions, but who they were and what they were like he never knew or remembered. "This must be one of her companions," he thought, glancing at the lady in the black dress. The princess rose quickly to meet him and held out her hand. "Yes," she said, looking at his altered face after he had kissed her hand. "So this is how we meet again. He spoke of you even at the very last," she went on, turning her eyes from Pierre to her companion with a shyness that surprised him for an instant. "I was so glad to hear of your safety. It was the first piece of good news we had received for a long time." Again the princess glanced round at her companion with even more uneasiness in her manner, and was about to add something, but Pierre interrupted her. "Just imagine! I knew nothing about him," said he. "I thought he had been killed. All I know I heard at second hand from others. I only know that he fell in with the Rostovs. What a strange coincidence!" Pierre spoke rapidly and with animation. He glanced once at the companion's face, saw her attentive and kindly gaze fixed on him, and, as often happens when one is talking, felt somehow that this companion in the black dress was a good, kind, excellent creature who would not hinder his conversing freely with Princess Maria. But when he mentioned the Rostovs, Princess Maria's face expressed still greater embarrassment. She again glanced rapidly from Pierre's face to that of the lady in the black dress, and said,
"Do you really not recognize her?"
Pierre looked again at the companion's pale, delicate face with its black eyes and peculiar mouth, and something near to him, long forgotten and more than sweet, looked at him from those attentive eyes.
"But no, it can't be," he thought. "This stern, thin, pale face that looks so much older, it cannot be she. It merely reminds me of her."
But at that moment Princess Maria said, "Natasha." And with difficulty, effort, and stress, like the opening of a door grown rusty on its hinges, a smile appeared on the face with the attentive eyes, and from that opening door came a breath of fragrance which suffused Pierre with a happiness he had long forgotten, and of which he had not even been thinking, especially at that moment. It suffused him, seized him, and enveloped him completely. When she smiled, doubt was no longer possible. It was Natasha, and he loved her. At that moment Pierre involuntarily betrayed to her, to Princess Maria, and above all to himself, a secret of which he himself had been unaware. He flushed joyfully, yet with painful distress. He tried to hide his agitation, but the more he tried to hide it, the more clearly, clearer than any words could have done, did he betray to himself, to her, and to Princess Maria, that he loved her.
"No, it's only the unexpectedness of it," thought Pierre.
But as soon as he tried to continue the conversation he had begun with Princess Maria, he again glanced at Natasha, and a still deeper flush suffused his face, and a still stronger agitation of mingled joy and fear seized his soul. He became confused in his speech and stopped in the middle of what he was saying. Pierre had failed to notice Natasha because he did not at all expect to see her there. But he had failed to recognize her because the change in her since he last saw her was immense. She had grown thin and pale, but that was not what made her unrecognizable. She was unrecognizable at the moment he entered because on that face, whose eyes had always shone with a suppressed smile of the joy of life, now when he first entered and glanced at her, there was not the least shadow of a smile. Only her eyes were kindly attentive and sadly interrogative. Pierre's confusion was not reflected by any confusion on Natasha's part, but only by the pleasure that just perceptibly lit up her whole face.
Chapter 16.
"She has come to stay with me," said Princess Maria. "The Count and Countess will be here in a few days. The Countess is in a dreadful state, but it was necessary for Natasha herself to see a doctor. They insisted on her coming with me."
"Yes, is there a family free from sorrow now?" said Pierre, addressing Natasha. "You know it happened the very day we were rescued. I saw him. What a delightful boy he was." Natasha looked at him, and by way of answer to his words, her eyes widened and lit up. "What can one say or think of as a consolation?" said Pierre. "Nothing. Why had such a splendid boy, so full of life, to die?"
"Yes, in these days it would be hard to live without faith," remarked Princess Maria.
"Yes, yes, that is really true," Pierre hastily interrupted her.
"Why is it true?"
Natasha asked, looking attentively into Pierre's eyes.
"How can you ask why?" said Princess Maria. "The thought alone of what awaits—"
Natasha, without waiting for Princess Maria to finish, again looked inquiringly at Pierre. "And because," Pierre continued, "only one who believes that there is a God ruling us can bear such a loss as hers and yours." Natasha had already opened her mouth to speak, but suddenly stopped. Pierre hurriedly turned away from her and again addressed Princess Maria, asking about his friend's last days. Pierre's confusion had now almost vanished, but at the same time he felt that his freedom had also completely gone. He felt that there was now a judge of his every word and action, whose judgment mattered more to him than that of all the rest of the world. And as he spoke now, he was considering what impression his words would make on Natasha. He did not purposely say things to please her, but whatever he was saying he regarded from her standpoint. Princess Maria, reluctantly, as is usual in such cases, began telling of the condition in which she had found Prince Andrei. But Pierre's face quivering with emotion, his questions and his eager, restless expression gradually compelled her to go into details which she feared to recall for her own sake.
"Yes, yes, and so?"
Pierre kept saying, as he leaned toward her with his whole body and eagerly listened to her story.
"Yes, yes. So he grew tranquil and softened. With all his soul he had always sought one thing, to be perfectly good, so he could not be afraid of death. The faults he had, if he had any, were not of his making. So he did soften? What a happy thing that he saw you again," he added, suddenly turning to Natasha and looking at her with eyes full of tears.
Natasha's face twitched. She frowned and lowered her eyes for a moment. She hesitated for an instant whether to speak or not.
"Yes, that was happiness,"
she then said in her quiet voice with its deep chest tones.
"For me, it certainly was happiness."
She paused.
"And he said he was wishing for it at the very moment I entered the room."
Natasha's voice broke. She blushed, pressed her clasped hands on her knees, and then, controlling herself with an evident effort, lifted her head and began to speak rapidly.
"We knew nothing of it when we started from Moscow. I did not dare to ask about him. Then suddenly Sonia told me he was travelling with us. I had no idea and could not imagine what state he was in. All I wanted was to see him and be with him," she said, trembling and breathing quickly.
And not letting them interrupt her, she went on to tell what she had never yet mentioned to anyone, all she had lived through during those 3 weeks of their journey and life at Yaroslavl. Pierre listened to her with lips parted and eyes fixed on her full of tears. As he listened, he did not think of Prince Andrei, nor of death, nor of what she was telling. He listened to her and felt only pity for her, for what she was suffering now while she was speaking. Princess Maria, frowning in her effort to hold back her tears, sat beside Natasha and heard for the first time the story of those last days of her brother's and Natasha's love. Evidently Natasha needed to tell that painful yet joyful tale. She spoke, mingling most trifling details with intimate secrets of her soul, and it seemed as if she could never finish. Several times she repeated the same thing twice. Dessal's voice was heard outside the door, asking whether little Nikolai might come in to say good night.
"Well, that's all. Everything," said Natasha.
She got up quickly just as Nikolai entered, almost ran to the door, which was hidden by curtains, struck her head against it, and rushed from the room with a moan either of pain or sorrow. Pierre gazed at the door through which she had disappeared and did not understand why he suddenly felt all alone in the world. Princess Maria roused him from his abstraction by drawing his attention to her nephew who had entered the room. At that moment of emotional tenderness, young Nikolai's face, which resembled his father's, affected Pierre so much that when he had kissed the boy, he got up quickly, took out his handkerchief, and went to the window. He wished to take leave of Princess Maria, but she would not let him go.
"No, Natasha and I sometimes don't go to sleep till after 2, so please don't go. I will order supper. Go downstairs. We will come immediately."
Before Pierre left the room, Princess Maria told him,
"This is the first time she has talked of him like that."
Chapter 17 Pierre was shown into the large, brightly lit dining room.
A few minutes later he heard footsteps and Princess Maria entered with Natasha. Natasha was calm, though a severe and grave expression had again settled on her face. They all three of them now experienced that feeling of awkwardness which usually follows after a serious and heartfelt talk. It is impossible to go back to the same conversation. To talk of trifles is awkward, and yet the desire to speak is there, and silence seems like affectation. They went silently to table. The footmen drew back the chairs and pushed them up again. Pierre unfolded his cold table napkin and, resolving to break the silence, looked at Natasha and at Princess Maria. They had evidently both formed the same resolution. The eyes of both shone with satisfaction and a confession that besides sorrow, life also has joy.
"Do you take vodka, Count?"
asked Princess Maria, and those words suddenly banished the shadows of the past.
"Now tell us about yourself," said she. "One hears such improbable wonders about you."
"Yes," replied Pierre, with a smile of mild irony now habitual to him. "They even tell me wonders I myself never dreamt of. Maria Abramovna invited me to her house and kept telling me of what had happened, or ought to have happened, to me. Stepan Stepanitch also instructed me how I ought to tell of my experiences. In general, I have noticed that it is very easy to be an interesting man. I am an interesting man now. People invite me out and tell me all about myself."
Natasha smiled and was on the point of speaking. "We have been told," Princess Maria interrupted her, "that you lost 2 millions in Moscow. Is that true?"
"But I am 3 times as rich as before," returned Pierre.
Though the position was now altered by his decision to pay his wife's debts and to rebuild his houses, Pierre still maintained that he had become 3 times as rich as before.
"What I have certainly gained is freedom," he began seriously, but did not continue, noticing that this theme was too egotistic.
"And are you building?"
"Yes, Savelich says I must."
"Tell me, you did not know of the Countess's death when you decided to remain in Moscow?" asked Princess Maria, and immediately blushed, noticing that her question, following his mention of freedom, ascribed to his words a meaning he had perhaps not intended.
"No," answered Pierre, evidently not considering awkward the meaning Princess Maria had given to his words. "I heard of it in Oryol, and you cannot imagine how it shocked me. We were not an exemplary couple," he added quickly, glancing at Natasha and noticing on her face curiosity as to how he would speak of his wife. "But her death shocked me terribly. When 2 people quarrel, they are always both in fault, and one's own guilt suddenly becomes terribly serious when the other is no longer alive. And then such a death, without friends and without consolation. I am very, very sorry for her," he concluded, and was pleased to notice a look of glad approval on Natasha's face.
"Yes, and so you are once more an eligible bachelor," said Princess Maria.
Pierre suddenly flushed crimson and for a long time tried not to look at Natasha. When he ventured to glance her way again, her face was cold, stern, and he fancied even contemptuous.
"And did you really see and speak to Napoleon, as we've been told?" said Princess Maria.
Pierre laughed.
"No, not once. Everybody seems to imagine that being taken prisoner means being Napoleon's guest. Not only did I never see him, but I heard nothing about him. I was in much lower company."
Supper was over, and Pierre, who at first declined to speak about his captivity, was gradually led on to do so.
"But it's true that you remained in Moscow to kill Napoleon?" Natasha asked with a slight smile. "I guessed it then, when we met at the Sukharev Tower. Do you remember?"
Pierre admitted that it was true, and from that was gradually led by Princess Maria's questions, and especially by Natasha's, into giving a detailed account of his adventures. At first he spoke with the amused and mild irony now customary with him toward everybody, and especially toward himself. But when he came to describe the horrors and sufferings he had witnessed, he was unconsciously carried away,
and began speaking with the suppressed emotion of a man re-experiencing in recollection strong impressions he has lived through.
Princess Maria, with a gentle smile, looked now at Pierre and now at Natasha. In the whole narrative she saw only Pierre and his goodness. Natasha, leaning on her elbow, the expression of her face constantly changing with the narrative, watched Pierre with an attention that never wandered, evidently herself experiencing all that he described. Not only her look, but her exclamations and the brief questions she put showed Pierre that she understood just what he wished to convey. It was clear that she understood not only what he said, but also what he wished to, but could not express in words. The account Pierre gave of the incident with the child and the woman for protecting whom he was arrested was this.
It was an awful sight. Children abandoned, some in the flames. One was snatched out before my eyes. And there were women who had their things snatched off and their earrings torn out.
He flushed and grew confused.
Then a patrol arrived, and all the men, all those who were not looting, that is, were arrested, and I among them.
I am sure you are not telling us everything. I am sure you did something, said Natasha, and pausing, added, something fine?
Pierre continued. When he spoke of the execution, he wanted to pass over the horrible details, but Natasha insisted that he should not omit anything. Pierre began to tell about Karatayev, but paused. By this time he had risen from the table and was pacing the room, Natasha following him with her eyes. Then he added,
No, you can't understand what I learned from that illiterate man, that simple fellow.
Yes, yes, go on, said Natasha. Where is he?
They killed him almost before my eyes.
And Pierre, his voice trembling continually, went on to tell of the last days of their retreat, of Karatayev's illness and his death. He told of his adventures as he had never yet recalled them. He now, as it were, saw a new meaning in all he had gone through. Now that he was telling it all to Natasha, he experienced that pleasure which a man has when women listen to him, not clever women, who when listening either try to remember what they hear to enrich their minds, and when opportunity offers to retell it, or who wish to adopt it to some thought of their own and promptly contribute their own clever comments prepared in their little mental workshop, but the pleasure given by real women gifted with a capacity to select and absorb the very best a man shows of himself. Natasha, without knowing it, was all attention. She did not lose a word, no single quiver in Pierre's voice, no look, no twitch of a muscle in his face, nor a single gesture. She caught the unfinished word in its flight and took it straight into her open heart, divining the secret meaning of all Pierre's mental travail. Princess Maria understood his story and sympathized with him, but she now saw something else that absorbed all her attention. She saw the possibility of love and happiness between Natasha and Pierre, and the first thought of this filled her heart with gladness. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. The footmen came in with sad and stern faces to change the candles, but no one noticed them. Pierre finished his story. Natasha continued to look at him intently with bright, attentive, and animated eyes, as if trying to understand something more which he had perhaps left untold. Pierre, in shamefaced and happy confusion, glanced occasionally at her and tried to think what to say next to introduce a fresh subject. Princess Maria was silent. It occurred to none of them that it was 3 o'clock and time to go to bed.
"People speak of misfortunes and sufferings," remarked Pierre. "But if at this moment I were asked, would you rather be what you were before you were taken prisoner, or go through all this again? Then for heaven's sake, let me again have captivity and horseflesh. We imagine that when we are thrown out of our usual ruts, all is lost. But it is only then that what is new and good begins. While there is life, there is happiness. There is much, much before us. I say this to you," he added, turning to Natasha. "Yes, yes," she said, answering something quite different.
I too should wish nothing but to relive it all from the beginning.
Pierre looked intently at her.
Yes, and nothing more, said Natasha.
It's not true, not true, cried Pierre. I am not to blame for being alive and wishing to live, nor you either.
Suddenly Natasha bent her head, covered her face with her hands, and began to cry.
What is it, Natasha? Said Princess Maria.
Nothing, nothing.
She smiled at Pierre through her tears.
Good night. It is time for bed.
Pierre rose and took his leave.
Princess Maria and Natasha met as usual in the bedroom. They talked of what Pierre had told them. Princess Maria did not express her opinion of Pierre, nor did Natasha speak of him.
Well, good night, Maria, said Natasha. Do you know, I am often afraid that by not speaking of him, she meant Prince Andrei, for fear of not doing justice to our feelings, we forget him.
Princess Maria sighed deeply, and thereby acknowledged the justice of Natasha's remark, but she did not express agreement in words.
Is it possible to forget? Said she.
It did me so much good to tell all about it today. It was hard and painful, but good. Very good, said Natasha. I am sure he really loved him. That is why I told him. Was it all right? She added, suddenly blushing.
To tell Pierre? Oh, yes. What a splendid man he is, said Princess Maria.
Do you know, Maria?
Natasha suddenly said, with a mischievous smile, such as Princess Maria had not seen on her face for a long time.
He has somehow grown so clean, smooth, and fresh, as if he had just come out of a Russian bath. Do you understand? Out of a moral bath. Isn't it true?
Yes, replied Princess Maria. He has greatly improved.
With a short coat and his hair cropped, just as if he had come straight from the bath. Papa used to...
I understand why he, Prince Andrei, liked no one so much as him, said Princess Maria.
Yes, and yet he is quite different. They say men are friends when they are quite different. That must be true. Really, he is quite unlike him in everything.
Yes, but he's wonderful.
Well, good night, said Natasha.
And the same mischievous smile lingered for a long time on her face, as if it had been forgotten there.
Chapter 18. It was a long time before Pierre could fall asleep that night. He paced up and down his room, now turning his thoughts on a difficult problem and frowning, now suddenly shrugging his shoulders and wincing, and now smiling happily. He was thinking of Prince Andrei, of Natasha, and of their love, at one moment jealous of her past, then reproaching himself for that feeling. It was already 6 in the morning, and he still paced up and down the room.
Well, what's to be done if it cannot be avoided? What's to be done? Evidently it has to be so, said he to himself, and hastily undressing, he got into bed, happy and agitated, but free from hesitation or indecision. Strange and impossible as such happiness seems, I must do everything that she and I may be man and wife, he told himself.
A few days previously, Pierre had decided to go to Petersburg on the Friday. When he awoke on the Thursday, Savelich came to ask him about packing for the journey.
What, to Petersburg? What is Petersburg? Who is there in Petersburg?
He asked involuntarily, though only to himself.
Oh, yes, long ago, before this happened, I did, for some reason, mean to go to Petersburg, he reflected. Why? But perhaps I shall go. What a good fellow he is, and how attentive, and how he remembers everything, he thought, looking at Savelich's old face. What a pleasant smile he has.
"Well, Savelich, do you still not wish to accept your freedom?" Pierre asked him.
"What's the good of freedom to me, Your Excellency? We lived under the late Count, the kingdom of heaven be his, and we have lived under you, too, without ever being wronged."
"And your children?"
"The children will live just the same. With such masters, one can live."
"But what about my heirs?" said Pierre. "Supposing I suddenly marry, it might happen," he added with an involuntary smile.
"If I may take the liberty, Your Excellency, it would be a good thing."
"How easy he thinks it," thought Pierre. "He doesn't know how terrible it is and how dangerous. Too soon or too late, it is terrible."
"So, what are your orders? Are you starting tomorrow?" asked Savelich.
"No, I'll put it off for a bit. I'll tell you later. You must forgive the trouble I have put you to," said Pierre, and seeing Savelich smile, he thought, "But how strange it is that he should not know that now there is no Petersburg for me, and that that must be settled first. But probably he knows it well enough and is only pretending. Shall I have a talk with him and see what he thinks?" Pierre reflected. "No, another time." At breakfast, Pierre told the princess, his cousin, that he had been to see Princess Maria the day before, and had there met... "Whom do you think? Natasha Rostova." The princess seemed to see nothing more extraordinary in that than if he had seen Anna Semyonovna.
"Do you know her?" asked Pierre.
"I have seen the princess," she replied. "I heard that they were arranging a match for her with young Rostov. It would be a very good thing for the Rostovs. They are said to be utterly ruined."
"No, I mean, do you know Natasha Rostova?"
"I heard about that affair of hers at the time. It was a great pity."
"No, she either doesn't understand or is pretending," thought Pierre. "Better not say anything to her either." The princess, too, had prepared provisions for Pierre's journey.
"How kind they all are," thought Pierre.
"What is surprising is that they should trouble about these things now, when it can no longer be of interest to them, and all for me." On the same day, the chief of police came to see Pierre, inviting him to send a representative to the faceted palace to recover things that were to be returned to their owners that day.
"And this man, too," thought Pierre, looking into the face of the chief of police. "What a fine, good-looking officer, and how kind! Fancy bothering about such trifles now. And they actually say he is not honest and takes bribes. What nonsense! Besides, why shouldn't he take bribes? That's the way he was brought up, and everybody does it. But what a kind, pleasant face, and how he smiles as he looks at me!"
Pierre went to Princess Maria's to dinner. As he drove through the streets past the houses that had been burnt down, he was surprised by the beauty of those ruins, the picturesqueness of the chimney stacks and tumble-down walls of the burnt-out quarters of the town, stretching out and concealing one another, reminded him of the Rhine and the Colosseum. The cabmen he met and their passengers, the carpenters cutting the timber for new houses with axes, the women hawkers and the shopkeepers, all looked at him with cheerful, beaming eyes that seemed to say, "Ah, there he is. Let's see what will come of it." At the entrance to Princess Maria's house, Pierre felt doubtful whether he had really been there the night before and really seen Natasha and talked to her. "Perhaps I imagined it. Perhaps I shall go in and find no one there." But he had hardly entered the room before he felt her presence with his whole being by the loss of his sense of freedom. She was in the same black dress with soft folds, and her hair was done the same way as the day before. Yet she was quite different. Had she been like this when he entered the day before, he could not for a moment have failed to recognize her. She was as he had known her almost as a child, and later on as Prince Andrei's fiancée. A bright, questioning light shone in her eyes, and on her face was a friendly and strangely roguish expression. Pierre dined with them, and would have spent the whole evening there, but Princess Maria was going to Vespers, and Pierre left the house with her. Next day he came early, dined, and stayed the whole evening. Though Princess Maria and Natasha were evidently glad to see their visitor, and though all Pierre's interest was now centred in that house, by the evening they had talked over everything, and the conversation passed from one trivial topic to another and repeatedly broke off. He stayed so long that Princess Maria and Natasha exchanged glances, evidently wondering when he would go. Pierre noticed this, but could not go. He felt uneasy and embarrassed, but sat on because he simply could not get up and take his leave. Princess Maria, foreseeing no end to this, rose first, and, complaining of a headache, began to say good night.
"So you are going to Petersburg tomorrow?" she asked.
"No, I am not going,"
Pierre replied hastily in a surprised tone and as though offended.
"Yes, no, to Petersburg, tomorrow. But I won't say goodbye yet. I'll call round in case you have any commissions for me," said he, standing before Princess Maria and turning red, but not taking his departure.
Natasha gave him her hand and went out. Princess Maria, on the other hand, instead of going away, sank into an armchair and looked sternly and intently at him with her deep, radiant eyes. The weariness she had plainly shown before had now quite passed off. With a deep and long-drawn sigh, she seemed to be prepared for a lengthy talk. When Natasha left the room, Pierre's confusion and awkwardness immediately vanished and were replaced by eager excitement. He quickly moved an armchair toward Princess Maria.
"Yes, I wanted to tell you," said he, answering her look as if she had spoken. "Princess, help me. What am I to do? Can I hope? Princess, my dear friend, listen. I know it all. I know I am not worthy of her. I know it's impossible to speak of it now. But I want to be a brother to her. No, not that. I don't. I can't."
He paused and rubbed his face and eyes with his hands.
"Well," he went on, with an evident effort at self-control and coherence, "I don't know when I began to love her, but I have loved her and her alone all my life, and I love her so that I cannot imagine life without her. I cannot propose to her at present, but the thought that perhaps she might some day be my wife, and that I may be missing that possibility, is terrible. Tell me, can I hope? Tell me what I am to do, dear princess," he added after a pause, and touched her hand as she did not reply.
"I am thinking of what you have told me," answered Princess Maria. "This is what I will say. You are right that to speak to her of love at present..."
Princess Maria stopped. She was going to say that to speak of love was impossible, but she stopped because she had seen by the sudden change in Natasha 2 days before that she would not only not be hurt if Pierre spoke of his love, but that it was the very thing she wished for.
"To speak to her now wouldn't do," said the princess all the same.
"But what am I to do?"
"Leave it to me," said Princess Maria. "I know..."
Pierre was looking into Princess Maria's eyes.
"Well, well," he said.
"I know that she loves..."
"Will love you,"
Princess Maria corrected herself. Before her words were out, Pierre had sprung up and, with a frightened expression, seized Princess Maria's hand.
"What makes you think so? You think I may hope? You think..."
"Yes, I think so," said Princess Maria with a smile. "Write to her parents and leave it to me. I will tell her when I can. I wish it to happen, and my heart tells me it will."
"No, it cannot be. How happy I am! But it can't be. How happy I am! No, it can't be,"
Pierre kept saying as he kissed Princess Maria's hands.
"Go to Petersburg. That will be best, and I will write to you," she said.
"To Petersburg? Go there? Very well, I'll go. But I may come again tomorrow?"
Next day Pierre came to say goodbye.
Natasha was less animated than she had been the day before, but that day as he looked at her, Pierre sometimes felt as if he was vanishing, and that neither he nor she existed any longer, that nothing existed but happiness.
"Is it possible? No, it can't be," he told himself at every look, gesture, and word that filled his soul with joy.
When on saying goodbye he took her thin, slender hand, he could not help holding it a little longer in his own.
"Is it possible that this hand, that face, those eyes, all this treasure of feminine charm, so strange to me now, is it possible that it will one day be mine forever, as familiar to me as I am to myself? No, that's impossible."
"Goodbye, Count," she said aloud.
"I shall look forward very much to your return," she added in a whisper.
And these simple words, her look and the expression on her face which accompanied them, formed for 2 months the subject of inexhaustible memories, interpretations, and happy meditations for Pierre.
"I shall look forward very much to your return. Yes, yes. How did she say it? Yes. I shall look forward very much to your return. Oh, how happy I am! What is happening to me? How happy I am!" said Pierre to himself.
Chapter 19. There was nothing in Pierre's soul now at all like what had troubled it during his courtship of Hélène. He did not repeat to himself with a sickening feeling of shame the words he had spoken, or say, "Oh, why did I not say that?" and "Whatever made me say, je vous aime?" On the contrary, he now repeated in imagination every word that he or Natasha had spoken, and pictured every detail of her face and smile, and did not wish to diminish or add anything, but only to repeat it again and again. There was now not a shadow of doubt in his mind as to whether what he had undertaken was right or wrong. Only one terrible doubt sometimes crossed his mind. "Wasn't it all a dream? Isn't Princess Maria mistaken? Am I not too conceited and self-confident? I believe all this, and suddenly Princess Maria will tell her, and she will be sure to smile and say, 'How strange! He must be deluding himself. Doesn't he know that he is a man, just a man, while I am something altogether different and higher?'" That was the only doubt often troubling Pierre. He did not now make any plans. The happiness before him appeared so inconceivable that if only he could attain it, it would be the end of all things. Everything ended with that. A joyful, unexpected frenzy, of which he had thought himself incapable, possessed him. The whole meaning of life, not for him alone, but for the whole world, seemed to him centred in his love and the possibility of being loved by her. At times, everybody seemed to him to be occupied with one thing only, his future happiness. Sometimes it seemed to him that other people were all as pleased as he was himself, or merely tried to hide that pleasure by pretending to be busy with other interests. In every word and gesture he saw allusions to his happiness. He often surprised those he met by his significantly happy looks and smiles, which seemed to express a secret understanding between him and them. And when he realized that people might not be aware of his happiness, he pitied them with his whole heart, and felt a desire somehow to explain to them that all that occupied them was a mere frivolous trifle, unworthy of attention. When it was suggested to him that he should enter the civil service, or when the war or any general political affairs were discussed, on the assumption that everybody's welfare depended on this or that issue of events, he would listen with a mild and pitying smile, and surprise people by his strange comments. But at this time he saw everybody, both those who, as he imagined, understood the real meaning of life, that is, what he was feeling, and those unfortunates who evidently did not understand it, in the bright light of the emotion that shone within himself,
and at once, without any effort, saw in everyone he met everything that was good and worthy of being loved. When dealing with the affairs and papers of his dead wife, her memory aroused in him no feeling but pity that she had not known the bliss he now knew. Prince Vasily, who, having obtained a new post and some fresh decorations, was particularly proud at this time, seemed